Okay, welcome to Journey into Excellence. My name is Vernon Bohr, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. Journey into Excellence is an ongoing series where experts in their field focus on how evidence-based promotion of liberty, life, and happiness pursuit requires clear thinking and civility in our family, education, and leadership management systems. Each of our expert panelists brings something unique to this discussion. Our panelists include Jack Malcolm, who is not here, so I won't give his credentials today, Dr. Martin Haysacker, Ph.D., professor of psychology at the University of Florida, and I believe he's the head of the department and all sorts of other good stuff, Brian P. Higley, Ph.D. Dr. Higley is president and CEO of the Building Blocks to Excellence, LLC, a company that focuses on promoting team excellence, personal effectiveness, and work-life satisfaction in individuals, teams, and organizations. And Mal Hyman, who's got a master's. Mal has a master's degree in sociology and is an associate professor of sociology at Corker University in Hartsville, South Carolina. And with that, as always, I'll turn it over to Dr. Higley, who will bring us up to speed and tell us what we're going to talk about today.
Okay, before I do, just a couple of little corrections. Dr. Haysacker is the former chair of the Department of the University of Florida, and then Coker College rather than Corker College. So missed it by an R. No big deal.
Yeah,
so,
I've got
what I want to do.
COVID brain fog.
No, that's okay. what I thought I'd do for new listeners is do my normal song and dance here and just talk about the history of Journey into Excellence. In year one, which was last year, we had a discussion that defined what excellence was, and the essence of it, for the purposes of this podcast at least, was civility and clear thinking. We think that excellence, at least for the purposes of this podcast, as mentioned before, is defined by being a clear thinker and being a civil person. So we went into last year defining what excellence means, and we used the power and control wheel versus the equality wheel from the Duluth model to compare and contrast suboptimal leadership and parenting and education with more optimal leadership, parenting, and education. In other words, we thought about economic abuse as being less excellent than economic partnership. We talked about how using coercion and threats is less excellent than using negotiation and fairness, how using intimidation is less excellent than engaging in non-threatening behavior, how using emotional abuse is less excellent than being respectful, how using isolation is less excellent than being trusting and supportive, how utilizing minimization, denial, blame, and distortion, including lots of different logical fallacies, is less excellent than honesty and accountability, including moving toward validity, how using the less powerful is less excellent than being somebody who joins with the less powerful and tries to empower them, and how using power privilege is less excellent than trying to spread power to more and more people. So that was year one. And in year two, which we're wrapping up today, we are answering the question, if the equality wheel is so much more excellent and so much more and helps people to think so much more clearly than the power and control wheel, why does it seem that so many people struggle with staying on the equality wheel a healthy percentage of the time? And the answer we're putting forth this year is that the reason for that, at least in part, if not in great part, is because it takes a heroic journey or heroic sort of process to move from being a power and control centered parent, educator, or leader to an equality-centered parent, educator, and leader. And so in our podcast this year, we went through the different stages of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. The first phase is separation, which has to do with moving away, for the purposes of this podcast, from power and control strategies and tactics. The second phase is initiation, which has to do with learning how to become more and more of an expert at equality wheel strategies and tactics. And we spoke a bit about how that initiation process, if you want to use the, the literature on expertise promotion, that you can think about initiation as about a 10,000-hour and 10-year process, give or take. And then the third phase of the hero's journey is return, which has to do with after you get initiated into power, or I'm sorry, it's into equality wheel strategy and tactics, that you return and try to bring it into your family system, to your education system, to your leadership system, and spread more and more equality wheel strategies and tactics. Last time we covered some of the different components of return, including what Joseph Campbell referred to as magic flight and rescue from without, which was basically all about moving from the initiation phase into the return phase where you start spreading what you've learned out into the world. And today I think we'll need to cover three different phases in order to wrap this up this year, or three different steps, I should say, in the return phase. The first is crossing the return threshold. And this has to do with taking the ultimate boon, which we discussed a few podcasts back, which is really, for the purposes of this podcast, becoming more clear thinking and becoming more civil and spreading that into your life more and more often, and then possibly spreading it out to other people in your family system, education system, or leadership system. The second step we'll cover today is called Master of Two Worlds, which has to do with achieving a balance between the material and the non-material world, sometimes thought about as the inner and the outer world. And then the third step within the return phase that we'll cover today is what is sometimes referred to as freedom to live. And this has to do with what I think about as living more and more mindfully, living more and more in the moment so that you are able to be, for the purposes of this podcast, civil and more of a clear thinker without getting caught up into worries about what that would mean into the future or concerns about the past, but you're living more and more in the moment, being a clear thinker, being a civil person, in the here and now. So with that, what I'll do is my normal process is kick it on over to Marty, who is our representative from the family system, and see if he's got anything he wants to say about crossing the return threshold, master of two worlds, and freedom to live steps in the family system.
Brian and Marty, before you jump in there, I just want to throw something out here that struck me because I've been through all the series the whole way. As I was listening to you, something came to mind that I want to just throw out there real quickly, and Marty can incorporate it into what he has to say. But I'm struck by the hero's journey. If I was put it in simpler terms or layman's terms or whatever, what strikes me is it begins with leaving behind the past. You know, we learn to navigate in a world that's controlled by the power control wheel. So we kind of, that's our model. And at that point, once we're, it's kind of almost like military training. You know, they say you got to beat you down, then they build you up, then they turn you loose. So the second phase is struck me as being like learning the new skills. You have to learn a new way to start to leave behind the power and control wheel. And the final step starts to take you into the journey of putting into application and practice these new skills and techniques and this new way of being into the world in which you live. So I just want to throw that out there so I didn't forget it.
Vern, before we get to Marty, I want to tell you that you triggered a memory in me. This was probably 10 years ago. I had a military person in one of my classes who characterized the approach I use called the H2O approach, help to ourselves and others, which uses just about everything we've talked about in these last 2 years. She characterized the class as educational boot camp, and she talked about it in very similar ways that you just talked about it. So I thought I'd throw that out there before I toss it on over to Marty.
Excellent.
I like that. So for our listeners, these last three steps, crossing the return threshold, master of two worlds, and freedom to live, represent the completion of the hero's journey. So one thing to really focus on as we're having this conversation today is we have been through a long journey with many steps, with tribulations and trials and successes and failures and temptations and insights. And so these last three steps are really the completion, the fulfillment. And so the first one is crossing the return threshold is the idea that you have gained wisdom from this experience and the ultimate boon. And now it's time to see if you can integrate that wisdom into your life and maybe share that with other people. So in the family, this could occur in a couple of different ways, one of which is that one of the members of a family who is now completing their hero's journey may have as their very first audience, as their very first opportunity to reflect the integration of the wisdom of the journey into their human lives, it could be that their first sharings are done with other members of the family. And so you may be a person in a family where a family member is saying things that are different, that are new, that seem to reflect insight, that seem to reflect pain and growth and change. And so when you experience that from another family member, keep in mind this might be that this completion or nearly the end of the completion of the hero's journey. So that's one thing. The other thing is that when you are a family member who has completed a heroic journey, your first audience for sharing what you've learned and what you're integrating might be your select family members, or you might sit down with all your family members at a holiday or an event or whatever and begin to share this. So that's one way this could play out in a family. Another way this could play out, crossing the return threshold could play out in a family, is that this process is sort of transformative of the whole family. And it might be that the whole family has sort of taken a journey together, or that a couple of the members of the family have taken the hero's journey and in the process changed the dynamics of the family. And so now the family has a different message that it's ready to share with the rest of the world. So that's crossing the return threshold and my thoughts about family. Master of two worlds and my thoughts about family are what Master of Two Worlds is about is balancing your inner life and your outer life, balancing the demands of the world, as Christians often hear from the Gospels, and your spiritual life or your life as a person of prayer, meditation, spirituality. And so how would this look in a family? In a family, it would look like you would remove or reduce these sort of membranes that are erected in many families where there's a staunch line between the spiritual and the material. So in my family, you know, we would curse and sweat and fight and, you know, not lie, cheat, and steal, but, you know, ish, until Sunday. And then on Sunday, guess what? We were in church on our knees praying. You know, we'd go to a novena, pray the rosary, light a candle. And then on Sunday afternoon, it'll be a little afterglow. But by, you know, Monday morning, we'd be right back at it. So with Master of Two Worlds, the family is not doing that. The family is integrating its spiritual world and its material world. It's being consistent all the time or most of the time. And likewise, a member of a family who is completing this hero's journey may challenge the family's bifurcation of the inner and outer world, or may call out the discrepancy between the family's spiritual values and what it's doing materially. And so those are processes that may go on in a family. And if you're a person in a family who's completing a hero's journey, you may find yourself surprised at sort of the hypocrisy or the inconsistency or the sort of splitting that a family does between its material existence and its spiritual existence. And remember, if you're that family member, you're the one who's completed the journey, and they're your world, and you want to invite them to a conversation. Lastly, with families, and then I'll let other people fill in and correct and improve, is the notion of freedom to live. This is the final stage of the hero's journey. And so what this means for a family member is you are free of something that has directly or indirectly, consciously and or unconsciously, often both, driven so much of your behavior, which is fear of death. So so much that animates some of the most crazy behavior that people do, and what that people do in families, has to do with what's called terror management by psychologists Greenberg and Pazinski. And terror management is managing one's fear of death. In freedom to live, you move past that. And in shifting your energies away from fearing death, life is more joyful, more powerful, more meaningful. And it also means that you have an opportunity to do something that we virtually never do, particularly in American families, which is live in the moment. For most of us in our families, we oscillate between being focused on the future. What are my goals? Am I going to make it? Have I got my retirement income? Can I get in college? Am I going to get married? Can we have a baby? Can I have another baby? All these future-focused things that take you away from the present, being centered. And these past things, here's how we do it in our family. This is what we're going to do. I still remember the time Mary made this big mistake. What we tend to do in families is be super focused on the past and hold people to, you know, the sins and transgressions of 5, 10, 20 years ago, or we're so super focused on the future we can't settle down and be present. But for the person in a family who's finished this journey and is on the freedom to live, you're calling the family to present-centered. You're calling the family to let go of too much future emphasis and too much past emphasis, and you're calling the family to quell its fear of death and thereby to live more deeply, more richly, more powerfully.
So, Marty, as you were talking, a conversation that I had with Mal, I don't know, Mal, if you remember this, but we had a conversation over breakfast at a restaurant a couple of years back, and we were talking a little bit about the political system, and these three steps came to my mind as we were talking, because one of the topics that came up is how difficult it can be to be a political person who sticks with their values, and that would be sort of the inner world that Marty was talking about in terms of the master of the two worlds, and then also dealing with the outside world, where so much of the outside world is, to go back to one of the steps in the initiation phase of the hero's journey, is so much about temptation, that if you move away from your values, I'll fund your campaign. If you say or do certain things that you don't actually believe, then I'll support your campaign. And these are the different steps that came to mind as we were talking about how do we, if you're a political person, how do you master the inner world of values and then the outer world of all these temptations? So I thought I'd share that memory with you, Mal, and then see if there's anything that comes to your mind in these three different steps.
Yeah, I remember that discussion. We were at Shoney's. We went on for a couple hours. Yeah,
yep.
I think it's a constant challenge for somebody who returns and wants to spread useful ideas that'll bring harmony. You were beset with a new set of temptations. I don't know if I shared when I declared for Congress in 2016, I met Nancy Pelosi at a fundraiser and asked for help from the party. She said, well, after you raise $700,000 and show us a poll that indicates you can win, we'll be glad to help you. And that was the end of the conversation. And if you do raise the $700,000, they take over your messaging so that you're not yourself. And if you do get there, you're expected to spend 15 to 20 hours a week raising money. Otherwise, you won't get your committee assignments. So the system is fraught with temptation, and you're always wrestling with the material and the non-material in trying to stay true to your thoughts and have the courage of your convictions. Now, for me, it wasn't that tough. I'd decided I was going to base the campaign on honor and common sense, so I was able to stick to my positions on things. But I can see why a lot of folks figure the ends justifies the means, and there's an awful lot of temptation there. I want to submit that this process in return, I think, ends up lasting a lifetime. And if you are true to yourself, you're going to continue wrestling with it in your family, in your community, country. And I think clear thinking will drive folks to ponder global citizenship, and maybe we'll return to that one a little later. So that's my first set of takes on that. We set up a system where in order to get ahead, you have to at best have made your money so that you're not tempted by all those who will give you advice and guidance and power once you get elected. And it can be done, but it is more difficult. And you were put in a position, I think, of saying the right thing and maybe planting a lot of seeds and expecting maybe you're going to lose the fight in the short term, but you'll raise the right issues. And, you know, I came to understand that was my role, and I felt okay with it, but it was a transition that I had to work my way through. And when I ran again in 2018, I understood it better, I understood the process better, and was less tempted, and I think was able to put things in better terms for people. But the temptation is always out there. And if I might shift to a personal level, you know, I think we're always going through this with family at all times as to how to work the material and the non-material world, even in the food we eat, which now is part of the debate on climate change. So it raises an ever-present set of questions or challenges, you know, at the family level, with risks of hurting or frustrating family members, even in the discussion of food safety.
You know, Mal, you so many times when you talk, it really just touches me. And what your latest remarks did was remind me of the book Diet for a Small Planet that was written, I believe, in the late 1960s or early 1970s by an author named LaPay, who makes just the point that you were making, which is that there are an array of foods that meet people's dietary needs, some of which are very hard on the planet and some of which are much easier on the planet. It's so interesting that you're bringing that up, and it is certainly critical and important right now with climate change, but this was presaged, 50 years ago maybe, by LaPay.
Right, I remember
as
that.
As you all were talking, I was thinking about, Marty, I think you mentioned in the final stage, this freedom to live being freedom from the fear of death. Sometimes I think people think death is only this physical death, but as you all were talking, I was thinking about other deaths that I think people fear in family and education and leadership systems, including the political system. So political death, I think, is something that politicians sometimes fear that tempts them away from saying the things that are truly their values. Social death, people can fear that in families and in the education system. So I thought I'd just quickly jump in and say I'd like us to expand the idea of death away just from the physical death, which can be fearsome, of course, but I think more often people in their day-to-day lives fear other kinds of deaths, like political deaths and social deaths.
So Brian and I have disagreed on very few things over the years, but this is actually a little place of disagreement between us, where I've contended for many years, and Brian can back me up on this, that all of these other deaths are really emanating from and reflections of the ultimate terror, the notion of our deaths and our physical deaths. And Brian has always politely said, no, I think of them as kind of different. So I'm going to hold my point. I think that what happens when you lose a marriage or lose a job or get ostracized or don't become reelected president or whatever, it is activating that terror that is the terror that a self-aware critter like human beings can have, that we are alive and therefore we know we're not going to be living forever. But I would love to hear.
Yeah,
Brian's
I don't
on
think
that.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a disagreement. I think all of these things are manifestations of fear of some sort of death, and I think it's possible and maybe even likely that if you could free yourself from a fear of physical death, that maybe these other potential deaths aren't so charged. So I think I disagree with your assertion that we disagree, because I think you can – I think
I do have a recent personal event, family event, that sort of touches on that. So as you all know, as we know, Mal just recently lost his spouse, and a few years before then, Vern lost his spouse, and I have not had that happen. But I did lose my mother in August, and so – That felt very deathy, very, as one of my dear friends says, it's as if you're an alien on the planet Earth and the mothership has left you behind. So I've had a profound connection with that. But what I was going to say is this year I also had a graduate student transfer away from me to a new advisor, which is kind of like a socio-professional death. And I think I would have been much more walloped by that, felt sort of like it was a loss or a failure or whatever. And I was strangely didn't have that. I just sort of lived it, experienced it in the moment, and wished the person well and made every arrangement for the transition to be as smooth as it could be. And I'm done. I've moved on. And I think maybe it's because I got pretty centered in my mother's death and pretty – grief-stricken about my mother and immersed in all of her life and all of her stuff and all of her writings. And so when this came along, I was sort of better prepared and more integrated, a little further along in my own little hero's journey.
Marty,
yeah, and I
and
can
Brian.
See go ahead, Vern.
I'll just throw this out as a thought, and then you can take over, Brian. I've got some other notes for later. But what if we were to think of death? What I'm listening to the two of you is, if I think of death as the ultimate loss, I think it covers both the loss of physical death, and you've got to really, you've got to die to be reborn. This is very Christian, too, in terms of metaphorically and stuff like that. And there's something, Mal lost his wife, I lost my wife, my brother-in-law and father in 2016. One of the first place I moved out of the house into was a mortuary when I was 18. We all experience death. Death is the ultimate loss. There's something that's inexplicable about it, Marty will tell you, because you might not see anyone for ages. There are people I haven't seen in 35, 40 years. But if I go to call them, they're still there. There's a sense of presence that's there. That when you lose someone like Marty, you lost your mother, they're gone. I mean, it's the ultimate loss, whether it be our own physical death or the physical death of someone else, that puts it into a different realm. And it makes me think of like Wittgenstein made a distinction in eternity, where he says, if you think of eternity as being something other than infinite moments in time, is timelessness. It's a perspective that shifts things, and so maybe that would reconcile the dialogue you and Marty have, Brian.
Yeah, I think you're talking about a bunch of things related to not just Christianity. Joseph Campbell would argue that that this idea of death into rebirth is actually something that's comes up in all these stories across time and across cultures. It's why the idea of dying and being reborn is in the hero's journey or the monomyth, because Campbell argued that this was actually a pretty common theme across a bunch of different cultures and a bunch of different times. But I think this is where I think you nailed it, Vern, if I'm understanding you correctly, because my disagreement about Marty's perception of me and of our disagreement is that I think, for example, maybe this will help, that sometimes people will say, if they're a politician, they'll say, well, I can't express my values because it would be a political death. A student might say, I can't express my values or my political leanings or my beliefs about different kinds of taboo things because it would be a social death. And someone might say the same thing in a family. It would be the death of our marriage. But I think very often people who are able to push through these fears and still live their values realize that except for the physical death, and of course there are certain philosophies that would even include physical death, include some kind of rebirth into heaven, but leaving that out, that if I can see the possibility of a potential rebirth, if my marriage dies, I can be reborn. If my social circle leaves me, I can be reborn into another social circle. If my political life dies, I can be reborn into some other sort of being. Then those so-called deaths lose their charge. So where I think Marty and I actually have some agreement is that I think if people realize that these imagined deaths aren't actually physical life and death, that they would lose their charge. And I think that's one way to maybe say, Marty, what you're saying about physical death being the real terror. It's just that sometimes we irrationally generalize that physical death out into potential social or political sorts of death. Is that in the ballpark of what you're thinking?
Yeah. And I'll just say it again. All the rest were just examples, things that were tacked on to it, like those little tendrils on the coronavirus, is that death is the ultimate loss. It's the ultimate. When you and I pass, this fear, what we are afraid of, and it ties into, as far as I'm concerned, what Marty's saying, is what greater loss is there for any one of us as people, human individuals that we can think of, than our we cease to exist.
Yeah, and I think Marty's point, and Marty, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that we can imagine that there are actual social deaths. We can imagine that there's political deaths, which means we're dead, but that's just imaginary. And if we can start to realize we can be reborn if we have a political death, we can be reborn if we have a social death, then you start to realize, well, the only death really is physical death. Marty, is that in the ballpark of what you're thinking?
You know, I'm not sure. It's one of these things where I got so close to it, I'm getting sort of blurry. I did have something happen with my mother that might be in a related vein, which is by the end of her life, my mother was done. She said, I've done all that I want to do. I've done all that I plan to do. I feel very fulfilled. I've taken care of the people I need to take care of. I've said the things I need to say. I've done the things I need to do, which I found really interesting. And at the end of her life, she passed away peacefully. I was right there. And she, that famous poem, there'll be no moaning at the bar when I put out to sea. That was my mother. And so I don't know, it, in a sense, I'm recognizing as we're talking about this, that it reflected a sort of a completion of her hero's journey. And my son and I, who loved her dearly, were both like, No, you're not done. You're sticking around. What about this milestone? What about this event? What about this thing? And she was very polite and very, solicitous and careful about our feelings, but she was done. She didn't change that she was done.
Yeah, my father was very much like
that,
Marty. He fell and broke his hip this time of year. In fact, it was December 17th, for what it's worth. And I went down and I sat in the hospital room for the next eight days with him, and I had to come back up for my wife's memorial on the 29th, and so I stopped by to see him for the last time in the hospital and offered to stay another day with his wife and my sisters and stuff. We weren't not as adept at dealing with that, And as we sat there, he says, I'm done. I want to die. Thrown in the towel. He could have lasted longer. The doctors didn't think that he was all that bad or whatever, but he was just really clear that he was done. And so at that particular point in time, we took him home, and his kidneys had not done well after they repaired his hip. But my brother's also a doctor, and then we thought it would probably take 2-3 days to pass. He passed within an hour of being home.
Wow. He just needed to be home.
You were talking, I thought of, I think this might be a Native American saying. I'm not sure. Someone might be able to correct me on this. But the idea that is pretty foreign, I think, to this culture of people declaring this is a good day to die. And I think this is another sort of aspect of this freedom to live through the freedom of the fear of death. I think there are certain cultures that have even less fear of the actual terror of death and the idea of this being a good day for me to die, that this is not in any way, shape, or form a bad thing. It's time. I've done my thing, and now it's a good day to die. So that came to mind as you all were talking. Mal, I know that
it was
you
a line from
say
it
something.
Was a line from the movie Little. It was a line from the movie Little Big Man, and I think it came from Dustin Hoffman's character.
It came from the chief. Dustin Hoffman
right.
Went out
the
there, and
it started.
It started to rain, and he packed everything up and said, "Well, I guess not. Today is not such a good day to die." As they walked off together.
I don't know if it was the first that movie was the first time it was uttered, but
probably
fair
not.
Enough. Mal, you were going to react to what? Mal, you were going to react to what Marty said. I was curious to know. Yeah,
I was going to circle back to notions of fears that maybe they're on a spectrum, and fear of loss of family respect or self-respect or fear of loss of social acceptance or loss of security, and then of course loss of a person in a way is a spectrum. And upon return, freedom to live, you may take a lot of risks, but you may not be worrying about terror management at the fear of death. And then I started thinking, even upon return, you're going through another cycle of separation, initiation, and a final return there as you're trying to spread new ideas, more clear thinking and civility. You're still challenging your family, your community, your country, and trying to be a better global citizen, and you're taking risks along the way, even upon the return. I guess it's kind of a Hindu notion of it. It's a continuing cycle.
You said, Mal, that the hero's journey is a lifetime journey, which I think is incredibly powerful. And one of the things that ties into what Marty was talking about along the way as I was listening there again, is my personal thoughts here, is that we on this planet, we're sitting here in this podcast, we are just a few individuals of like 7 billion. So we're part of a global community. And as such, we're only as evolved in this world as the least evolved of us, so to speak. And I was thinking once you make the return and you go to your family, Marty, I was thinking about the family is probably the smallest cohesive unit that humans know of, where you start to work together. And then you start to take it out. If Jack was here, we'd talk about our business communities and stuff. And so that I don't know that you can really, unless you can make the return and take it back into the world and manifest it there and have it carry further out, it's kind of all for naught.
Yeah, I think, one of the things that came to mind as you were talking, Vern, is, and this is something I think we covered a bit with Jack last time, is that if you do the initiation process, and for the purposes of this podcast, let's say you become a clearer thinker by minimizing some of the most common fallacies that people buy into. We talked about that a couple of years ago. You don't appeal to the bandwagon. You don't just say something's true because it's popular. You don't appeal to authority. You don't say something's true just because a lot of people who have a lot of money or influence say that it's true. And then you become better at civility. So one of the people who I always think about, I think I've mentioned him quite a few times over these last 2 years when I think civility, is Dr. Carl Rogers, a person-centered approach to therapy, to education, to leadership, centered around being genuine, being regardful, and being empathic. So you train your mind to pick up and minimize all these fallacies so that you can move toward validity. You become a more genuine, regardful, and empathic person, and then you do nothing with it. You don't act in more genuine, regardful, and empathic ways toward other people. You don't encourage people to stop appealing to fallacies over actual reason and evidence. Then that makes that initiation process less heroic and maybe not really all that heroic at all. So I think Campbell had it right when he had all three of these phases, that you do need to separate out from fallacy-based thinking and from the power and control wheel in order to initiate yourself into more valid ways of thinking and more equality wheel, living, learning, and leading. But if you stop there, you don't actually go back to your families, you don't go back to your classrooms, you don't go back to the political realm or to the business realm and try to spread this stuff, I think people could wonder, well, what was it all for?
And Brian, you don't get in shape once and last for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Life is and that's actually what as I'm thinking about it now, that's the heart of it. It's an ongoing thing. You know, there's no such thing as becoming transformed, enlightened, and then you sit back on your laurels. Life is a constant dynamic process, it seems to me. And when you were talking, that's the exercise thing came to mind, is, you know, you don't go to the gym, get all pumped up in shape, and now I'm in shape, and so I can go eat anything I want, lay around, watch TV, eat popcorn, I'll be in shape for the rest of my life. Unless you're constantly using it, you lose it, as that old saying goes.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the return phase is the ultimate in using it. You know, you go out into the world where there's all sorts of dangers. The road of trials comes to mind, an earlier step in the initiation phase. And if you don't subject yourself to the road of trials, then you aren't as fit, to use your metaphor, Vern, as you could possibly be. Mal, were you going to say something?
You said it better than I would have said it. You know, upon return, the trials continue. They just get more complicated because you're more patient and more confident and have more strategies and ideas for dealing with them, and honor dictates that you'll deal with them. So it never ends, and it's good to have a community when you do return. Of those who are taking greater risks. And, I remember how worried I was before my first civil disobedience. I thought, my God, I've been in prison. I know what they can do to me. And I was running 5 miles a day to just get up the courage because I didn't know what was going to happen next. And then after I went through it, I was kind of, my God, I worried way too much. But it sure helped to have some people, you know, at that stage who were going to take the risks as a support group, fellowship, just as it's good to have this conversation.
Now,
yeah, one of the reasons, real quick, Vern, that I was excited to have everybody on board with this. When Vern first proposed the podcast, he asked whether I wanted to do it, and the first thing I thought of was, let me get all of these people who have been such a part of my own, I call it STEAM team. STEAM stands for social support, time, perception, enjoyment, accessibility, and motivation. So you all are have been major social support networks to me, but the idea of a podcast with some of the key members of my own STEAM team that have helped me through my road of trials all these years was exciting for that very same reason, that if we could all get together, talk about this stuff every month or so, that we can probably all have the STEAM, so to speak, to get out there and do our hero's journey in the month between our talks. Vern, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was intrigued by what Mal said, but I want to say something else first because they don't know it. Brian and I interact a lot on Facebook, and we talked about the podcast. And my point of the way I saw it at one particular point in time is, come on, Brian, let's do it or get off the pot. When are we going to do it? When are we going to do it? When are we going to do it? And here we are, and it's fantastic. I was just thinking when Mal said that, there's a very strange distinction I've come to grips with in my life, is you can never be over-prepared for anything. You can be over-prepared, but that doesn't matter. What really matters and hurts you is if you're underprepared. If you're over, you were talking about preparing for your, and that struck me when I was an undergraduate and I took an organic chemistry test. And what I realized is that I knew about 80%, 70% of the information very well, depended where the questions came from, how well I do on the test. And I did well. And it struck me is you can never be overprepared. You can, all that really matters is if you're underprepared. If you learned more than you needed to, or you prepared more than you needed to, you haven't lost on that. You just haven't used it. But if you don't prepare sufficiently, that's what hurts you.
Third, that gets to the heart of why I now at least offer the different steps of the hero's journey in all of my courses. Because I think this 17-step approach is as good as any that I've seen, model that prepares people for what Joseph Campbell used to say. He said, if you give people the map, then once they get to the territory, they're prepared, to use the word that you're talking about. And I think these 17 steps are as good as any model that I've seen of the map that you need to be prepared for, at least a map that prepares you for the terrain, I should say, if you do really want to get to this freedom to live place where you are mastering two worlds, that internally you have I sometimes think about this as self-mastery, that you know your values, you live your values, you're what Campbell used to say, you're a circle rolling out of its own center. And then in terms of the outside world, you have what I sometimes refer to as interpersonal expertise. So when people come at you because you're civil, or they have trouble with you because you're thinking more clearly than you used to, then you have the interpersonal expertise to manage the outside environment in the form of other people. And then the third thing I talk about a lot is mission connection, which to me is all about making sure that no matter what other people or the world throws at you, you have enough self-mastery and interpersonal expertise to be able to stay connected to the mission. And part of the mission to me of these podcasts is to continue for ourselves to keep thinking about how we can be clearer thinkers and more civil within our little group here, and then how we can also do that for others. And as you all might remember, I like the acronym H2O, which to me stands for help to ourselves and others. So I think this podcast, at least for me, it's help to ourselves so that we can stay focused on the mission once a month or so. And then one of the reasons why I was so excited, Vern, at your idea to put it into a podcast is that maybe it could also be a form of help to others on almost a monthly basis. People can listen to these ideas and maybe get more and more steam up for living their values as well.
And now that it's out here, Brian, it will live in its own way for a long time. It'll transcend us.
And that's what mission connection to me is. Is that you're doing something that's about more than just yourself. Not that it's not about yourself, because to me the acronym H2O includes both. You know, it is, I hope, useful to everybody on this podcast. But we're also sending it out into the world so that it could possibly be helpful for others, as you said, Vern, for the foreseeable future.
It's an ultimate expression of self, I would say, Brian. When it goes beyond you and me, that, these are just my reflections. God doesn't talk to me at 3 a.m, doesn't come streaming through my window, so I'm not telling you anything that I'm a authority on, but it just seems to me that's the ultimate expression of self.
And to me, that gets back to this last step, Vern, this freedom to live, which is supported by mastery of two worlds, my inner self and then the world outside. I think in order to optimize one's self-expression, it is super helpful to be what Fritz Perls, who developed Gestalt Therapy, used to say, getting into the here and now. And that's one of the Gestalt people, like Carl Rogers, they are considered humanistic psychologists. And I believe it was him. If not, it was somebody else writing about Gestalt Therapy. They were asked to summarize, well, what is Gestalt Therapy in its essence? It's getting people into the here and into the now. And so often people, they might be, their physical selves might be here, and Marty and Mal, I think, can relate to having students whose physical selves are in the classroom, but it seems like their minds are miles away. And I think so often people are thinking not about here, they're thinking about other places, and they're not living in now. They're either caught up in their past or worried about their future. And I think this freedom to live idea is about liberation from getting caught up in the past or the future. Not that you can't, when you want to, in a mindful way, consider the past and plan for the future, but that you're doing that more mindfully. And instead, you practice more and more often being in the here and now, which makes it easier, I think, to face some of the threats that Mal talked about. You know, what are the risks? Well, the risks, when you're thinking about risks, you're thinking about the future, right? If I do A, then B might come back to haunt me. And what I think this model is all about is saying, well, in the here and now, you want to make sure that you minimize risk. But if you get caught up in imagining these risks, and Mal had said that the risks were worse in his mind than they were in reality. But if you can get into the now, you can do what I heard on some show. I forget what show it is. I wish I could reference it properly. But I heard on some show someone said, well, things are so uncertain. What is it that we should do? And the response was the next right thing. And I think when people are liberated from being caught up in the not here or the not now, it becomes easier and easier and easier to just do the next right thing.
For what it's worth, I would love to hear Marty and Mal share what they can regarding the hero's journey and how it applies to the loss of, in Mal's case, his spouse, and in Marty's case, his mother, both things that have happened quite recently.
Marty, you can go first on that if you want.
I mean, I think the major insight I actually got during this radio blog, which is that my mother was completing a cycle of her hero's journey. I don't think it so completely struck me until today, as we were talking about all these things, and I was walking through what she had done in the final months of her life. So I think that's what struck me about this, was that I had missed that she was rounding that circle for the final time, and that she completed and she left.
Marty, could I say something? I want to say something very specific and personal to you, okay? You are your mother's gift to the world, in my eyes. And I want you to remember that. And and I said it to you. You are your mother's gift to the world. And as she leaves this world, these are just reflections that I've come to grips with my own life. With her goes a piece of you, as with you is left behind a piece of her.
Thanks, Vern. That touches me.
I mean it very sincerely. You are her gift to the world, as your children are your gift to the world. Brian is your daughter, is your gift to the world, and as you are the gift to your parents, and now your parent, you are the gift to your parents to the world. That's one of the ways I've come to see life that kind of integrates this all. You know, my father and my wife left behind with me pieces of them, and they took with them pieces of me.
Vern, as you were talking, I hearken back to one of the steps in the hero's journey in the initiation phase, the ultimate boon. And and thinking about people as the ultimate boon, you had said that that Marty's mom left a gift in him, and I agree with that. Marty's been a gift to me for decades, an important ultimate boon, as has everybody else on this podcast. And so I have everybody's mothers and fathers to thank for that. But it also made me think about back to Carl Rogers' work on genuineness, regard, and empathy. And I think that what you said is so profound that if people could really even just get that one insight, and we've talked before about the difference between intellectual and experiential insight, from saying, yeah, everyone's a boon, to really getting it, that everybody is a boon from somebody else's parents, that could be something that just that one insight, I think, could shift the entire world in major ways, and in many of the ways that we've been talking about across this podcast. And as I talk, I think so much about what Mal's mission in life has been about helping individuals and then also helping the world. So I feel like I want to toss it on over to Mal after sharing those thoughts. Mal, did that trigger anything for you?
Plenty, and it's been beautifully said by Vern. I see my youngest daughter as a reflection of my wife and myself, and we knew when she was born, I was 45, Carol was 41, so we knew this would be the last, and we threw ourselves into raising her, and great kid, was able to hear the best in what we were saying. I don't think we ever really raised her voice with her. She's a smart kid, an easy kid. And my wife and I determined that all extra money was going to go to her foreign travel when she hit the ninth grade. So we made sure she traveled somewhere and figured that was the most important thing, for her to travel with friends and see the world. And mine was perplexing because Carol had diabetes and Alzheimer's, and I wasn't prepared to see a lot of the changes, and neither was my daughter. But I hearkened back to a lot of really strong memories, and that when we got married, it was to a notion out of Micah: do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. So every time I'm doing that, I'm with her, and my daughter knows it. So I think we do live on in different ways, and I suppose in a very real sense, you know, if you take prophets or saints seriously, and you hear those voices occasionally, and they inspire you, you know that teachers and sages from earlier times are impacting you, and you're really a combination of all sorts of forces, and you come to realize you're yourself, but you've had all these influences. And I think with Carol we got along great because she had a sense of honor too, so we would disagree, but I guess in the Jeffersonian notion of agreeing to disagree agreeably, And I see my daughter doing that. She found a really great guy, and she's in love, and it came at a good time of her life. So, yeah, I see us as a range of forces impacting on us, and in the law should reflect anew in ways that you never would imagine. Anyways, I appreciate you guys indulging my discretion, digression on this.
Yeah, I don't think that's a digression at all, Mal, because you, as you were talking, I started thinking about yet another philosophy that Campbell considered as he was putting together this hero's journey monomyth. I thought about the Buddhist notion of that suffering, even though suffering and that sort of a pain, I think in many cultures is considered something to be avoided. This Buddhist notion that suffering, because it is so common, is a way in which to bring us all together. And when I thought about the idea of being able to connect, I thought about another ultimate boon, this ability to connect with self and with others through suffering. And it brought me back to the step crossing the return threshold, this idea of retaining wisdom gained on our quest. And as we've been talking about today, so much of our quest includes people coming into our lives and leaving our lives. So it occurred to me, Vern brought up people leaving our lives. And my experience with death this year was with our beloved dog, Nico, whose death I responded to as intensely as any death that I've responded to in terms of a human being. I was actually just floored by how much his death impacted me. I wanted to see, does anybody have anything to say about wisdom gained from the suffering of loss this year? And this has been such a year of loss, so probably good to touch base on loss in this year 2020. Any thoughts on wisdom that's been gained and integrated into life through these losses?
My take on it is that loss is a revealer. It's a revealer of good things as well as of bad things. And so, for example, I see the executive branch's response to the staggering loss of American life, and I see something I frankly never ever in my worst nightmares thought I would see, which is just brazen indifference, and that is a reaction to loss. I also see cases where, like I think my youngest son has grown and developed through his struggle of the loss of his grandma, and that's been a really great thing to see. So I think loss, it's sort of like pressure. It's a form of sort of pressure that reveals the strengths and the weaknesses of that which is being pressed.
Mal, Vern, any thoughts on wisdom gained and integrated from these awful losses?
I don't know if this is wisdom, but I'll share something that I carry a little pocket recorder with me all the time, and one of these days maybe I'll transcribe a bunch of stuff. But I was on a walk probably 6 months ago, and I recorded this and pretty much transcribed it. This is a thought that went through my mind. So I just share this, and what I wrote down, what I said in the recorder is, the way the sadness washes over me in the silence and the aloneness that accompanies me on my daily walk. Where some may attempt to avoid the pain that comes with such sadness, I do not, for it is also part of the sum total of those experiences from which my life has been forged. Like the loss of innocence that can never be replaced, losing one who became a part of one's soul is a loss that can never be replaced. I try to welcome the sadness, embrace it, encompass it, embody it, knowing even as I do so, I do so not to make it go away or avoid it, but do so to honor the loss represented by the sadness. And I shared that with one of my good friends from the Army that we still talk regularly. And his email back was, if there's no loss, there tend to be no honor.
I'm glad you said
that. Mal, any thoughts on, yeah, you have any thoughts, Mal?
Well, I was overwhelmed.
Wisdom gain?
For sure. Between the diabetes and the Alzheimer's, I was overwhelmed, so I came to understand other people's suffering a lot better. I hadn't been that off balance in my adult life and had to deal also with my daughter's sorrow and become more grateful for each day. And I think afterward, more grateful just to be alive and recognize the need to take a lot more risks for what I think is honorable.
You know, as you all were talking, I thought of a couple of things I thought I'd share and then toss it on over to Vern. One, for me, in terms of loss, either my own loss or hearing about other people's losses like yours, the sentence just appeared in my mind as I was listening to you all. I feel centered in loss, and I think it gets to that Buddhist philosophical idea that suffering is one of the commonalities that every human being, no matter how rich or poor or tall or short, can relate with in some way, shape, or form. So I think I feel centered and connected, maybe more so than in any other experience, than in being in my own loss and hearing about other people's losses. And then the other thought that I had as you all were talking is how much this loss seems to, and I think I'm hearing it from all of us, correct me if I'm wrong, that part of the wisdom that comes from loss, Mal mentioned it, is related to that last step in the hero's journey, freedom to live, living in the moment. I think what I learn from loss and from hearing from other people's loss, and I think it's probably wisdom, is that it's important to live as many of my moments as possible, because I never know when I'm going to pass or when other people are going to pass. And so why not be in the here and now, to get back to that gestalt idea that I think is related to freedom to live. Vern, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I just want to really acknowledge Mal for his journey. If your wife had Alzheimer's, it was probably for quite some time. And I think that it's hard for people to fully appreciate the toll that a lingering illness takes on the one that cares for the family member. And I really want to acknowledge you for that. You know, I had my own experience with that. My wife was first diagnosed with lung cancer in 2004. Her second bout was in 2008. She had a metastasis in 2009, 2012, fell and broke her hip in 2014, which ended her career. She actually worked all the way through all those bouts with cancer as a hairdresser, something she loved to do. Fell and broke her hip in 2014. And then bottom line is I have a lot of familiarity with being in hospitals, emergency room visits, you know, this, that, and whatever. So I just really want to acknowledge that now, because it's one thing. My father went very quickly and very peacefully. I mean, he did break his hip, and that was last week, but he made the decision. But you lived through a lot, and it takes – that's the kind of courage that I see Teddy Roosevelt talking about in his Man in the Arena, is that we tend to – if I was going to call it wisdom, I'm not going to say this is wisdom. We tend to romanticize what we call our heroes, when in fact – life itself for every one of us in one way or another is a hero's journey beyond the Joseph Campbell. It takes a lot to live life and handle what's thrown at you on a daily basis. And those that came before us, from the Carl Rogers to all the great, great people throughout history, were nothing other than humans taking the same going – marching in the same parade that we are, except they came first and we're behind them. And I think there's some real power in coming to grips with our own humanity that the whole story of time and history tells. And it's not me. It's not just Mal. We are all faced with this journey. The extent that we can come to the grips, if you will, of our humanness, accept that, there's some real power. So anyway, I wanted to really acknowledge you for that, Mal, because I can really appreciate or have a sense of what you went through with your wife and the love that was there. And my brother-in-law, at the last Thanksgiving I spent with him, when we had to help my wife down some steep steps on the wheelchair, I was walking, working outside the other day, and I was just struck when he said to me at that particular point in time, "Oh, so that's what love's about." And I was just moved by the fact that many notice our actions in life that never say it to us vocally, but we're appreciated in this world.
Well, I appreciate that. I really came to see the angelic nature of nurses and good doctors. And it was a really humbling experience. I think we need
go ahead now.
Well, you come to recognize the faltering of all institutions and, you know, watch the medical system falter at a number of points. And instead of speaking in class about human rights and knowing that you need to compare different systems and we could learn a lot from other systems that create more dignity and harmony and save money and all that, and then you're in the midst of it and you just see how terribly perverted it was by profits and how it fails people and doctors are overextended and don't follow through very well. And, you know, you get 2015 hindsight of all the mistakes the doctors made along the way. And you don't have too much time to ponder it. You just have to deal with things and administer morphine and Ativan and make sure you get it right on the home front. And, you know, in retrospect, you can look back and see a greater need for institutional change. So hopefully I can bring that forward in a practical way.
As I listen to everybody's stories, one of the things that occurs to me, at least in this culture, and I guess I'm contrasting it to some of these other cultures that I think are better at sitting in suffering, at recognizing the role of suffering in all of our lives. And in some cases, Vern and Mal both used the word honor, being able to honor suffering. I think so often some of the stories that we're telling in this culture can, in some cases, cause people to want to move on from these quote-unquote negative, I don't think of them as negative stories, because I think through these stories we connect. And it just occurred to me, I wonder if suffering and the honoring of suffering does help us connect, and if it is true that in our culture people aren't so comfortable with suffering, I wonder if we got better at honoring our suffering and honoring other people's suffering, if we might not get better at connecting. And if we got better at connecting, maybe we would get better at coming to see that we're all an ultimate boon. Every individual is. And maybe we would, to Mal's point, maybe we would put these ultimate boon human beings before some of the temptations like materialism, egoism, and hedonism. These are the three categories that I talk about when I talk about temptation. And instead of getting caught up in those temptations, that we started to make these ultimate boon fellow human beings priorities.
Don't everybody speak at once. I'm sure you have something to say, Marty.
Nope. Well, I'm loving what we're doing.
Yeah, me too. I think there is more empathy through suffering and vulnerability. And I'm not sure how you harness that, but it does cause more empathy and greater reflection.
Yeah,
well,
I heard something.
One of the things. Go ahead, Vern.
No, I heard something years ago that's always stuck with me. And my life is a compilation of very simple little snippets. Not very many, you know, that show up along the way. Your life goes on every day, and we get up. I go about my business and stuff. Certain things stick with me, but something that stuck with me through the years is that very few people can be just sad and recognize
yeah.
sadness is sadness. I'm sad today, you know, and that's something I've striven for, tried to embrace and encompass, made part of my life through the years, is that when I'm sad, can I just recognize it as being sad and let it be and be with it and let it be part of me?
See, Vern, that gets to my earlier points about how I think in this culture we're less good at honoring suffering and sadness than maybe certain other cultures are. And one of the things that I like one of the stories or ideas, I guess, that I put out there, when people get sad and they either tell themselves, I can't be sad, or if somebody starts to cry and somebody else says, don't cry, is I like to sort of ponder, well, why is it that when people laugh, we don't tell them, don't laugh? Why is it that when we're laughing, oftentimes we don't think to ourselves, I should stop laughing? So I just think it's really interesting to play around with the idea of why are we more comfortable, so many of us anyway, with our laughter and other people's laughter than we are with our sadness and crying and other people's sadness and crying. And what the cost of that might be, if it is true that one of the major and deepest ways in which to connect is to honor our suffering and honor other people's suffering and sadness. What ultimate boon are we missing out on in the form of deep connection when we keep telling ourselves and other people that it's okay to laugh and be happy, but not okay to be sad and cry?
Yeah, you cut out part of your...
Brian, I'm sorry, let me jump in quickly. It's
yeah.
clear that Brian has never gotten the giggles during a funeral, because if he had, he would know how painful it is to be laughing at the wrong time. And I confess, I have gotten the giggles at a funeral more than once. I've been to a lot of funerals,
okay.
So I'm a little bit to be forgiven. But, you know, you've been up all night, you're stressed, and some ridiculous thing happens, and you're giggling in the back of the funeral, and it's just kind of, yeah, not good.
I think that's the outlier.
It has no disrespect
to my point.
It has no disrespect for the deceased either.
No, but everybody in the room thinks that you do.
Yeah, that's funny. I pulled up a quote that I'm fond of, and I read parts of it I hadn't read before, but I share it. I think it ties in. It says, life cannot wait until the sciences have explained the universe scientifically. We cannot put off living until we are ready. The most salient characteristic of life is its coerciveness. It's always urgent, here and now, without any possible postponement. Life is fired at its point blank. And culture, which is but its interpretation, cannot wait any more than can life itself. And it took me back to when my granddaughter was 5 and we were all going to Disneyland one day, and I was chuckling to myself. I turned to her, I told her to look me in the eyes. I says, Kylie, I'm going to tell you something that you'll probably forget. But if you remember when you're in trouble, when you're older, it may help you. And I looked her in the eye, says, it's all going to work out. And where that came from me is I was looking at my life at a crisis or something going on. And I realized, as I thought back in my life, of all those incidents that I thought that had occurred, that I thought, how am I ever going to make it through it? And I had. And I was struck by the fact that here I was many decades later and still this stuff would come up in life that, oh, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do now? Without realizing that life kind of works out.
Vern, as you were talking, I thought about the one of the previous steps in the initiation phase, the road of trials. I think you're explaining the utility of the road of trials, that if we encounter enough trials in our lives and make it through it, then we start to come to the conclusion that no matter what trial we have, that it'll work out. And it makes me think of some of the research. You mentioned science in your quote from Albert Bandura on self-efficacy or self-confidence. And one of the major ways in which to increase self-efficacy and self-confidence is to have past experiences where you succeeded or made it through. So you made me think of Campbell's Road of Trials and Albert Bandura's self-efficacy theory as you were speaking.
Brian, I was put here for one reason and one reason only with respect to these podcasts, to make you look good.
you set me up. Perfect.
I couldn't resist that one. That's the imp in me.
The other thing that you set me up for, Vern, in a nice way, and I swear we didn't plan this beforehand to our listening audience, is in your quote, there was mention of life and here and now pretty close to each other. And that,
yes,
again, brings me back to the final stage of freedom to live, which is getting into the here and now. And it made me think of the idea that life is in the here and now. And if you get too caught up in the past or the future, maybe you're not really in your actual life, which is not only a principle from the hero's journey, it's also the essence, as I mentioned before, of Gestalt therapy. Get yourself into the here and now, because that's where life is.
And it's always there. By the way, anyone that's interested in looking up the quote, it was Jose Ortega y Gasset that comes from, and that stuck with me for many, many years. The other thing, you've asked about wisdom, and I don't know that this is wise, but we always hear people talking about being here now, living in the moment, here and now, as if it's something to ascribe to. The fact of the moment, the fact of the matter, as far as I'm concerned, is there's nothing to do with regard to that, because that's the only time you can live.
Yeah. It's the only thing we have. That's the point of Gestalt therapy and Fritz Perls, is that you're in the here and now, even if you're imagining that you're not. So why not get to where you actually are?
Yeah, whether your thoughts. Go ahead, Laura. I'm sorry, Marley. I talk too much.
All I was going to say is, and it is absolutely the essence of the final step in the hero's journey, which is the final step we're talking about in this podcast.
Yeah, you can't live other than where you are right now, always, even if that right now always is with your head, projecting you into the future or the past.
And speaking of final steps, I know we're in our final moments here of the final podcast of 2020. So, Vern, you want to close us up here for one last time this crazy year?
Well, I just want to wish everyone a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year's, Happy Hanukkah, all of it. Whatever is going on in life, we live in another one of my favorite quotes just ends it. We live in this marvelous world, this mysterious world. You know that we're all going to be here too short a time to witness the marvels of it all. And if we can appreciate every day as it comes at us with everything. No matter how mundane it is, you can make life interesting. You can have fun with it. And to that end, here's what I'll share, and then I want to throw it open to everyone else. My daughter, 2 years ago, when I was faced with Thanksgiving, she's worried I was going to have to spend it alone. And I just very calmly told her in the phone call, "Don't worry, Lisa. If I have to spend Thanksgiving alone, I can't think of anyone I'd rather spend it with." And to anyone listening to this, when you come to the point that you can be at peace with yourself, that's when you truly have the possibility of being with peace with others, I believe. And I believe the same thing holds for forgiveness, is until you can get to the point that you can recognize, and I hope we talk about forgiveness in the future, truly forgive yourself for anything that you think you need to be forgiven for. That's the point you can start to truly open up and forgive and love people to the fullest extent possible. And as I said earlier, whatever I share or say in this universe doesn't come to me from God at 3 a.m. Some people talk like God talks to them. These are just my perceptions and the way I've come to see life, and I throw it out there. If it fits, use it, wear it, use it. If it's not useful, don't. And it's been a delightful year for me with all of you, in spite of COVID-19 and everything else we're facing on this planet.
Well, I'll jump on top of that, Vern, and one of the things you mentioned, COVID-19, and of course, COVID-19, when I think of that, again, I think of the road of trials and all the different trials that so many of us have gone through. And this has been a year of loss for so many people, including so many of us here on the podcast. And one of the things that, or one of the lessons, I think, that we get through these trials and these losses, to kind of circle back to what we've been talking about today, this freedom to live, at least to me, is how important it is to get into the here and now and appreciate people in the here and now and appreciate as many of your own moments as possible, because you never know when you're going to lose people. You never know when it's going to be over for you. So, I just want to thank all of you, and I know Jack and John aren't with us, so I'll thank them as well. These almost monthly podcasts have been really helpful to me in terms of getting into the here and now. Every time I get done with the podcast, with any of these podcasts, I feel more in the here and now. And so maybe what I'll do is thank you all for being a part of my here and now team, helping me get into as many moments as possible. And maybe I'll send that out to a wish for everybody who's listening. May you have more experience of the here and now and more days and weeks and months and years ahead. So thank you all. And my best to everybody in terms of enjoying as many here and nows as possible.
Well, I'll echo that sentiment. Go ahead, Marty.
No, I was going to literally say the same thing, Mal. I echo that sentiment.
I was just going to share the advice I've given my daughter, to try to sum it up and keep it short and sweet. I've told her, take your best shot and don't worry about it. And enjoy the journey. And I don't think I was wise enough to say that to my oldest daughter, but I think that summed it up pretty decently, and I want to thank everybody for these dialogues. I've really enjoyed participating, and they've been inspiring to me, and look forward to them in the future, and happy holidays to everyone.
And with that, to the listening audience out there, those of you that are listening along the way, we wish you a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, a wonderful life, live in the moment. We will catch you after the first of the year in our ongoing series here of Journey into Excellence.